On This Week in Enterprise Tech, you're most likely working remotely and have a student doing so as well. How's your connectivity? Well, with the large remote workforce out there, connectivity is still a problem. We'll talk about it. Plus, are you and your organization still using telnet services? Say it ain't so. Well, there might be a botnet targeting you, and you should be probably go fix that. Now, is your organization wanting to grow globally and looking for highly available networks? Well, today we have Shashi Karan. He's the Chief Product Officer at Ariaka to talk about SD-WAN solutions and how to scale your business without all the red tape. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 414, recorded October 9th, 2020. Data on Cloud 9. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Forward Networks. Forward Networks reduces business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's advanced technology center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like VMware. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world, the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. What better way to bring in the experts to guide us through this all, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Lou. This has been an important week. You know, we had Interop Digital earlier this week. I was part of the cybersecurity crash course, and we had a great couple of days. So it was a lovely way to spend the week. Have a number of other conferences coming up for different companies and different groups over the next few weeks. It's not the next best thing to being there, but given where we are, it's pretty darn good. So I'm hoping to see some more of the Twyatt Riot out there in the bitstream.
Great to have you. Now, is all that content, is that on demand? Can you go somewhere and get it?
Much of it is on demand, so check back to go to the interop.com website. You'll find out how to see stuff on demand. All of it was recorded, so if you have a coworker or if you were there earlier, you can always go back and rewatch one of those sessions.
Fantastic, fantastic. Yeah, I was busy, but I caught some of it. I'm going to get some more, so thanks, Curtis. Well, folks, speaking of a busy week, Chibert, welcome to the show. Mr. Brian Chi, he's not only our geek in paradise, but he's also net architect over at Sky Fiber. How are you, my friend? How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I've been seeing all kinds of really interesting pictures from wireless internet service providers all over the nation, sending in pictures of 5G microcells. And it's going to be really interesting this, well, I would imagine rollouts are going to be beta this year and maybe have a real rollout next year.
Looking forward to it. Now, I heard through the grapevine that you were on a security panel with this week. How did that go?
It was a whole lot of fun. And truth be told, I think Padre and I kind of scared Leo.
He's going off the grid for sure, I think. Even the chat room agrees
perhaps.
Here. So did you guys talk about what was going on in the, like, what was the topics of the security panel?
Oh, basically it was red team versus blue team. Padre and I came up with ways that we thought we could get into their networks, and the other guys basically said what kinds of policies, what kinds of things would they do to keep us out.
Interesting. Sounds fun. Well, definitely, guys, go check that out because that's on demand right now over at the twit.tv website. But we got to get started because this has been a busy week in the enterprise. We got a lot to cover. Now, you're mostly likely working remotely or have students that are doing remote as well. How's your connectivity? Well, some new data is actually showing that in the U.S., there's still a huge problem there. We'll get into that. And are you or your organization still using Telnet services? Say it ain't so. Well, if you are, there's a bot that's out there targeting you. We'll go through how that might impact your organization. Is your organization growing globally and looking to ensure the network is highly available, redundant, and resilient? Well, today we have Shashi Karan. He's the Chief Product Officer of Arayaka, and he's here to talk about SD-WAN solutions and how to scale your business without all the red tape. But before we get into all those exciting things, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, do you remember Do Not Track? Well, that's the initiative that was supposed to allow browsers and users to reclaim their privacy on the web. Well, if you don't know already, it wasn't a successful campaign. Now, not only did websites ignore it, but there's a debate point that it could actually make people less private because they actually stuck out. Now, privacy advocates are back in with a new specification, and this time, they brought the lawyers. Now, under the hood, the specification is known as Global Privacy Control, and it works pretty much the same way as Do Not Track. But basically, a small HTTP header informs sites that visitors don't want their data sold. Now, the big difference here was from the previous model is that the enactment of the Consumer Privacy Act in California was added with support from the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe. Now, these give consumers broad rights over their private information and how it can be used. And at the moment, California residents who don't want websites to sell their data must register their choice with each visit. In fact, sometimes it's quite annoying because you have to do that every time you visit the site. Now, the California law contemplates explicitly, quote, user-enabled global privacy controls such as a browser plugin or privacy settings might help here. Now, the single, they actually want that choice. And that's what the Global Privacy Control or GPC does. As defined by the researchers of this new initiative, it, quote, it's the goal of the effort to help define a mechanism that could satisfy initially CCPA's requirements for global privacy control. And it also extensible to apply to other privacy laws such as GDPR and should help make policymakers deem it adequate for exercising those rights in their jurisdiction. Now, so far, only Brave and DuckDuckGo browser developers are the only ones who have committed to implementing this control. Now, other supporters of GPC include the New York Times, the New York Washington Post, Financial Times, WordPress.com, Tumblr, Glitch, DuckDuckGo, Brave, Mozilla, Disconnect, and a bunch of others. In fact, even the EFF. Now, Firefox and Mozilla have tentative plans for support here. Now, but it seems to me you have to get the big dogs, the ones that have the market share to buy in on such a campaign and move the needle here. Now, unless we see Chromium and WebKit, which is used by Safari, jumping in on the bandwagon, this initiative will probably fail too. Now, if regulation requires GPC, it will force the big players to support it in their platform and make sure that the markets move as well there. Now, what do you think? Do we need regulation or do we need to convince the browser makers that it's a good idea? Love to hear from you.
Well, a rare firmware rootkit has been discovered targeting diplomats and NGOs. You know, this is a silent and deadly threat long dreaded by security experts, malware that's entrenched in the firmware of modern computers that can't be expelled by reinstalling the operating system or even wiping and replacing the hard drive. These mostly invisible firmware rootkits, aka bootkit, attacks have thus far been very rare, but researchers at Kaspersky have discovered one in the wild. The custom rootkit compromised the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, UEFI, in computer chips that handle system booting and loading the operating system. The malware implant, which was just one module found in a larger attack framework Kaspersky named Mosaic Regressor, appears to be written by a Chinese-speaking actor based on several artifacts and language clues in it, according to the researchers. The attackers pointed Mosaic Regressor at African, Asian, and European diplomatic and NGOs between 2017 and 2019. All of the targets had some link to North Korean interests, either as nonprofits focused on the country or with locations there. The Kaspersky researchers say they weren't able to pinpoint exactly how the attackers were able to plant the bootkit on the victim machines and rewrite the legitimate UEFI firmware. Now, this is only the second known case of a bootkit attack in the wild. The first, revealed 2 years ago by ESET, was used by the Russian nation-state hacking group Fancy Bear, also known as SEDNIT, SOFACY, or APT-28, which was best known for its 2016 attack on the Democratic National Committee.
SpaceX Starlink broadband has been available in limited beta for the past few months, and SpaceX has now launched enough satellites for a public beta that will be available to more customers. However, the newly launched satellites aren't in position yet, and SpaceX hasn't revealed an exact availability date. After yesterday's launch of 60 Starlink satellites, SpaceX CEO Elon Musk wrote on Twitter that once these satellites reach their target position, we'll be able to roll out a fairly wide public beta in northern U.S. and hopefully southern Canada. Other countries to follow as soon as we receive regulatory approval. Musk did not say when the satellites will reach their target position. SpaceX has over 700 satellites in orbit after yesterday's launch. It could take a few months for all the 60 new satellites to reach their target positions, according to some astrophysicists. Jonathan McDowell of the Harvard Smithson Center for Astrophysics. McDowell has been tracking the Starlink satellites' orbits and providing updates on his website. Typically, SpaceX splits each batch of 60 satellites into three groups of 20, McDowell told Ars Technica. The first group would reach target height in about 45 days, the second and third after 90 and 135 days roughly, he said, which means all 60 satellites might not be in their target positions until around February 18th, 2021. So while this could potentially spell bad news for rural ISPs, especially wireless internet service providers, this is good news, especially for those AT&T customers that are getting termination notices for their AT&T DSL services in rural America. All in all, this kind of service is going to be a double-edged sword. But I, for one, am really looking forward to being able to use this to get data out of some very remote areas for science without having to rob a bank to pay my iridium bills.
Now, you may have heard of that little Supreme Court case out there called Google versus Oracle. It's just a small one going on. Now, to put it into perspective, this case has the potential to impact the future of software development as we know it. Now, as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, states, allowing copyright on APIs is a terrible idea for computer science worldwide. Now, that's because almost all modern software depends on open APIs. Now, when you are web browsing around, it works with Amazon and Apple, Microsoft. Any complex site really works with an API, and it communicates through those APIs. Now, when your smartphone shows you the weather or directions to the doctor or a video, it uses APIs to bridge the gap between services and servers for your device. Well, Oracle argues that Google has infringed on Oracle's copyright by copying the, quote, structure, sequence, and organization of 37 Java APIs inside Android. Google replied that an API is like an alphabet or a grammar, the fundamental elements used to create programs. I tend to agree here. The U.S. District Court of North Carolina, or Northern California judge, William Alsup. He's one of the few judges who actually knows how to program here. He ruled in Google's favor about years ago, and he wrote that an API is mere, quote, a long hierarchy of over 6,000 commands to carry out pre-assigned functions. For that reason, it cannot receive a copyright protection, patent protection perhaps, but not copyright. Now, Oracle lost its Java patent lawsuit long ago, but in the SCOTUS filing, Microsoft stated, consumers expect to be able to take a photo on their Apple phone or save it to Google's cloud servers and edit it on the Surface tablets. Furthermore, Microsoft argued that programmers rely on, quote, sharing, modifying, and enhancing previously developed code to create new products and develop new functionalities. Now, without the ability to reuse functional code to create new things, innovative follow-on development will be compromised here. Now, if I personally ignore the arguments of all the large conglomerates and give you my opinion here as a code monkey and a developer, APIs should not be copyrighted. Definitely not. We spend our professional lives bringing value to the world by providing nuggets of useful information and data through programming interfaces. Now, sure, some can charge for APIs by encapsulating their platforms, but the APIs themselves should be copyright-free. Now, sorry, Oracle. Sorry about that. Now, even though this is my opinion, I actually am interested in hearing yours. So send me a tweet or two over at LouMM.
Well, it's 2020 and cyber attacks are up, but companies are mostly succeeding in securing their remote workforce. According to a report by threat hunting tools provider Domain Tools, more than half of surveyed companies, or 56%, stated that they are prepared to support a fully remote workforce, with about a third tightening security policies and settings to do so. Now, since the onset of the pandemic, more than half of firms say they have detected at least a moderate increase in cyber attacks, while 1 in 10 firms have encountered a drastic increase. Yet, the increase in attacks has not led to an increase in breaches, with 16% of firms experiencing a breach in the past 12 months compared with 15% for the same period in 2019. Overall, companies saw more attacks, but mainly common vectors such as spear phishing, malware, and business email compromise. More than a third of companies surveyed said they saw active or suspected cyber attacks every day. In June, more than three quarters of companies had the majority of their employees working outside the office, according to PwC. But overall, fears that the chaos of the coronavirus pandemic and massive shift to remote work could lead to more frequent security incidents and breaches have failed to be realized, said Tim Helming, security evangelist at Domain Tools.
Well, AT&T is reportedly moving ahead with its plan to sell DirecTV despite receiving bids that value the satellite division at less than one-third of the price AT&T paid for it. AT&T bought DirecTV for $49 billion in 2015 and has lost 7 million TV subscribers in the last 2 years. In late August, news broke that AT&T is trying to sell DirecTV to private equity investors, and that deal could come in at less than $20 billion. The reality is AT&T's DirecTV and DSL services could very well both be victims of emerging space-based systems like those from SpaceX and perhaps soon Facebook. Either way, the emergence of systems like SpaceX will be offering is going to initiate a sea change for communications providers.
Well, there's an old proverb in information security that's every company gets penetration tested, whether or not they pay for someone to do so or not. Unfortunately, many organizations that do hire professionals do test their network security posture, tend to focus on fixing vulnerability hackers could use to break in. Now, judging from the proliferation of help wanted ads for offensive pen testers in the cybercrime underground, today's attackers have exactly zero trouble getting the initial intrusion here. Now, the real challenge seems to be hiring enough people to help everyone profit from the access already gained. Now, one of the most common ways such access is monetized these days is through ransomware, which actually holds a victim's data and/or computers hostage, and until they extort payment out of it, is they actually don't make anything. Now, most cases, there's a yawning gap of days, maybe even weeks or months between the initial intrusion and the deployment of ransomware within an organization. Now, that's because it usually takes time and a good deal of effort for the intruders to get from a single infected PC to seizing control over the entire resource or the entire network. Now, once control is gained, they launch the ransomware. Now, this includes pivoting from or converting a single compromised Windows user account to an administrator account with greater privileges on that targeted network. Now, each day, millions of malware-laced emails are blasted out on containing booby-trapped attachments, and at this point, control over the victim's machine may be transferred or sold multiple times between different cyber criminals who specialize in exploiting such access. Now, these folks are often contractors who actually work with established ransomware groups, and a paid set of percentage of any eventual ransom payments may be made by that victim company. Now, sure, you can find one-off instances of this behavior, but several other seasoned cyber criminals are customers of popular ransomware as a service offerings that are hiring subcontractors to farm out some of the grunt work. Now, this is a rapidly growing market for compromised accesses, and the fact that these could be sold to anyone, organizations need to focus more on efforts to understand and detect and quickly respond to network compromisers. Now, that's the golden point here, detect and respond. Now, what are organizations doing here? Well, some are beefing up their perimeter security. No matter how strong your perimeter may be, the problem is what happens if someone slips under the radar and gets in, right? That's what's going on here. This is the foundation of zero trust. And I think it's time organizations take a pause and start spending the dollars to implement it. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Ford Networks. Now, we talked about it today. Connectivity and your network is instrumental in the success for your business. It's mission critical. Well, Ford Networks will help you reduce network outages. They help you improve troubleshooting, and they eliminate errors. Now, they reduce business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Now, four Stanford PhD graduates developed Ford Networks, and 7 years ago, they developed empathy for network operators and sought to apply principles of modern software development to networking. Now, the secret to their effectiveness is in the amazing software. They have advanced software that delivers a digital twin of the network and a completely accurate mathematical model of software and actually serves a single source of truth for the network. Now, users can verify that their network is configured correctly through this and is it compliant or does it have the right policies and if it's behaving exactly as it's intended to behave. Now, they can accurately predict the impact of a proposed change across every possible traffic path so network operators can roll out changes with confidence. You're always worried about deploying changes. Well, this is a way to model it out. Now, it ensures that your network stays healthy and agile at the same time. Now, here's some of the other things that Ford Network does for you. Their dashboard provides key insights with visualizations, and they're easily consumable and exportable. They automatically create an always accurate network diagram with full details about the topology of your environment. Plus, search network behavior, configurations, and state network-wide with a powerful set of tools. You can perform end-to-end path analysis across your network and from both on-prem and cloud infrastructure, plus proactively identify those potential connectivity and security policy violations as well. Now, verify that your network is configured and behaving exactly as intended across on-prem, cloud, and virtual overlay networks. Set, check, and customize those policies for your entire network in one place. You can do behavior diffs, which actually allow you to do that side-by-side comparison and one quick view of configuration file changes for any device between any points in time. A lot of cloud services can use that out there. Now, get 50% faster resolution of network trouble tickets, 90% faster fixes related to audit processes, and 33% reduction in aborted network updates due to identifying errors. Imagine searching your network for what's causing problems. Ford Networks allows you to do that. Now, PayPal is having issues with their network and considered building a better system. Instead of, they actually turned to Ford Networks and found that all they need was software that could help them find the trouble spots, saving them time and money. Now, Ford Networks collaborates with a range of infrastructure and application technology partners from the world's leading IT companies to innovators. Now, they've worked with Bank of America, Verizon, Goldman Sachs, and several large government agencies as well. Now, Ford Networks announced their Series C funding just recently, last October, led by Goldman Sachs, and also participating were Andreessen Horowitz and Threshold, formerly DFJ. In total, their investments are now committed $65 million. Get network automation and verification for your intent-based network with Ford Networks. Your business depends on it. Get a demo at fordnetworks.com/twit. That is fordnetworks.com/twit. And we thank Ford Networks for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, speaking of networks, let's talk about the elephant in the room, remote work, school, and life. It can be good, right? But that's only if you have reliable and consistent connectivity. Think about the times you're working hard and your connectivity goes down and it goes down the toilet. Well, it's debilitating. It can stop your work. It can prevent you from being productive. It's not uncommon for households in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, to lose internet for a full day. That's the last time it happened back in spring. There's a professor, Christina. She's a professor at Northeastern State University, and she's teaching online. Plus, she not only connected herself and her son to kindergarten, but he's also learning online, and they use a hotspot on their phone when their things go out, when the regular internet goes out. Now, luckily, nobody had a Zoom call scheduled today because worksheets and YouTube videos proceeded as planned. However, they are one of millions of students around the U.S. who are currently taking some time of taking their classes remotely here. Now, since the spring, for many districts, that's been status quo, which moves infrastructure and instruction online to limit the spread of COVID-19. And the first weeks of school were difficult for lots of rural families because teachers struggled to reach disconnected students using phone calls, social media, and text messages almost 7 months later rural districts around the country still scrambling to accommodate all their pupils. Now, listen to this. Part of the problem for rural areas is income. And according to Pew Research Center, just over half of households with annual revenues under $30,000 use broadband internet. Now, the average cost of internet service is about $60 per month in the U.S. And in areas where cable isn't available, some families need to turn to satellite service, as Cheever talked about a little bit, which is even more expensive at $100 per month on average. Now, that's a cost not all families can bear here. Now, high-speed internet isn't an option even for some households that can afford the service. Now, the FCC broadband standard is a download speed of at least 25 megabits per second and upload speeds of 3 megabits per second, dubbed the 25-3 plan. Now, these speeds are unheard of in some rural areas. Now, just two-thirds of Americans, rural Americans, had broadband access compared to three-quarters of urban residents and 79% of suburban residents. But it's hard to measure how widespread the service actually is. But laying cable in areas where very few paying customers live isn't an attractive investment for a lot of providers out there, including regions that hit a lot of power outages here. Now, modernizing rural broadband across the country could require well over $130 to $150 billion infrastructure costs here. Now, personally, I'm seeing schools provide hotspots for people who don't have internet access, but that's if you have coverage for those things. Otherwise, they don't work. What is the alternative? What needs to be done here? I want to throw this to my co-hosts. Curtis, what do you think? What's going on here? What can be done?
Well, I mean, you're right. This is absolutely an economic issue. And I think it's important to note that in many of these areas that we're talking about, the issue is last mile. There is an astounding amount of dark fiber out there. So it's not as though the infrastructure isn't in place to do the backbones to these areas. It's all last mile. And the fact is that most of the companies that serve these communities, if they can provide what their customers will pay for via UTP or some other form of copper, aren't going to pull fiber to the residents. So without some sort of subsidy or some sort of basic economic reordering, I don't think we're going to see a huge change unless or until something like Starlink comes up and offers better service for a much lower price using a vastly different infrastructure and business model.
All right. What do you think, G-Bird? I mean, is Starlink the answer here?
Actually, I think the answer is for legislators to get off their butt and do something. So one of the huge, huge topics at Wispapalooza that I attended in Las Vegas before this madness was how there was an insane amount of money available for last mile. Gee, where'd it all go? Well, it went to the big boys. And we all know that the big boys just used it to do whatever. So we don't know. It certainly wasn't for rural broadband. And now, one of the biggest boys on the block is AT&T, and they are dumping DSL, which, oh, gee, is providing marginally broadband services over unshielded twisted pair, UTP. You know, in fact, most DSL is provided over even older copper. You know, back when everything was 50 pair bundles. So what do we do? I don't know. The wireless internet service providers have been scrambling. There's been lots and lots of seminars. In fact, Wispapalooza was just online, and one of the big seminars was, how the heck do you apply for this federal money? And the interesting thing is, and I'm going to toot the horn of the folks at Wispapalooza, and that the vast majority of the wireless internet service providers in this nation are actually providing broadband services, truly broadband services, wirelessly, for less than $100 a month. Many are less than $50 a month. And I've seen a whole bunch that are under $30 a month. Gee, That sounds like the answer, but WISP are having problems. They can't get the backhauls. They can't get permission. And they constantly run into one red tape roadblock after another. So, yeah, I think SpaceX and so forth, Starlink, might be an answer, but we still don't quite know how much it's going to cost. And will it fit into the budgets of some of these folks? Now, I also should point out, this isn't just rural America. It's also inner city America, where these lower cost income areas are sitting on really, really ancient infrastructure. And because of the lack of profits, you know, because they can't afford it, a lot of the big boys aren't dragging fiber. They aren't upgrading the infrastructure. They aren't even fixing the infrastructure. So it's not just rural America. It's just Americans that can't afford a premium broadband service.
Right. I want to bring up, I mean, Digimax in the chat room had a good point. He said, you know, I would pay for fiber. It was in my area. It brings up a good point about, we talked about in the past about community fiber, right? Community internet, where, you know, communities to come together, they charge, you know, they work on the infrastructure, and that's paid through whether it's taxes or something else. Is this another way that maybe some areas, including rural areas, could take a little bit more control of this and help spread more connectivity throughout the community? What do you guys think?
I think that's a great idea. In fact, one of the things a lot of people keep forgetting is that the GPON service, you can actually run gig Ethernet, well, not full gig, but you can run very fast services over a single strand of single mode fiber, and each leg can go outwards of 10 kilometers. So if you're going to drop it off, say, for instance, the drop off for a farm might be at the highway, and then the farmer is going to be responsible for getting a chunk of fiber or copper from the highway into their farmhouse. That's affordable. I think it needs to happen. I think there's a lot of things that could happen. And I think community broadband is one heck of a great solution. And if anyone is thinking about it, there's lots of organizations. Just do an internet search for community broadband help. Lots of interesting things out there. In fact, I just got a press release from one, and we're going to try and work them into the schedule for Twilight.
Fantastic. Well, I think that segues nicely into the next topic we talked about. We'll talk about the next bite here. Now, I want to throw this to you, Chiwert. You know, we hear a lot about legacy technologies being used by a lot of people, by a lot of organizations, and how they just need to be replaced or just not being used anymore because they're insecure. What are we talking about here?
Well, what we're talking about here is a new botnet that's targeting exposed telnet services. Now, it's a nice detailed article. I'm not going to read it. Right now, in all reality, telnet exposed to the internet is one of those duh technologies. Why? In this day and age, I mean, it's even to the point where Mac OS and Windows have both removed telnet. But I scratch my head and going, well, wait, telnet's actually a useful tool for testing things like email sending, SNMP, all kinds of stuff. What needs to happen is telnet needs to be removed on the other end. And this is the problem, especially with IoT devices. So many are based upon ancient versions of Linux. And these people are leaving telnet on there because they're just doing... In some case, I actually found an IoT camera with a default installation of Linux, for goodness sakes. And Telnet was open. SNMP was open. In fact, it was SNMP read community string of public and write community string of private. It's like, why? So this article really and truly is more about a wall of shame. If you are making a product that has Telnet open, shame on you. In fact, if you are doing a product or a service that has Telnet open, you cannot play in the military. You cannot play in the U.S. federal government. You cannot play in any Internet 2 institution. Open Telnet, unencrypted logins are illegal in all those organizations. Now, has that made a difference? I don't know. Kurt, I think this is for you. This is almost a policy thing. Should we actually be mandating within our organizations, thou shalt not have unencrypted logins, period? Or is there some middle ground?
I think that would be a great thing to mandate in organizations. The problem with so much is that we can mandate that going forward. We would have to pick a date in the future, and just to pick one, let's say January 1st, 2022. Point on, no more unencrypted logins. And we can even say no Telnet. We can say nothing about particular services and protocols being used. We can do that. The issue really is all of the millions and millions and millions of already deployed IoT devices that are sitting in the field doing critical work and can't be modified. Those things are going to be there acting as time bombs and security holes, if not decades to come. And I'm not sure that there is a great solution to that, because let's face it, trying to do a forklift upgrade on entire operational technology networks is a non-starter for just about any company that has more than, say, half a dozen of these things deployed.
Well, you know, Lou made a really interesting comment. Telnet, unencrypted logins, you know, Telnet, FTP, you name it, should be on private networks. But what about SSH, which is inherently an encrypted access technology? And I'm, you know, Lou sounds like he's got some great opinions. Lou, what do you think? Is that safe enough just doing SSH?
You know, in my opinion, obviously, Telnet was built to just private networks. And even then, if you have somebody rogue on your private network, they're going to sniff it. They're going to sniff your username and password. So it's not a good service to use no matter where you are. So just get rid of it. It's common sense. But I think the next thing, obviously, being SSH, a lot of organizations use it. And they say, hey, it's still, you know, I can still securely do this because the traffic is encrypted. I think the biggest problem here is it's still using things like username and password. So if I we just steal somebody's username and password as they type it in, I could then SSH into a service no matter where I'm at over VPN. I can hide myself and I can still access it remotely. So there's still much need to put an overlay over top of that to make it more secure. Now, there are ways to do it. And if you're not using things like OpenID, ID Connect, and SSH certificates, then you're doing SSH wrong. So I think there's a lot of work here to be done to make these things more secure. You can't just use them out of the box. And I think that's really the key here, is making sure that your organization is doing the research, if you need to use one of these things, to be able to contact and connect security. And that goes with also IoT devices. If you think about it, a lot of IoT devices today sometimes are administered by using things like remote commanding through SSH and so on. And so if it's not implementing these more secure things, you're still open to potential attacks, especially just as easy as someone stealing a username and password. So I think, you know, should these things be used? Probably not, unless you can implement a really secure pipeline and a way to guarantee that rogue users couldn't get in.
Well, all good advice. We need to get better at this. Come on, people. Anyway, we've got a great guest coming up, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of really cool things. But you know what? I'm going to toss this back to Lou, because he's going to talk about a Twiot sponsor.
Thank you, G-Bert. That's right. Next up, we have a really great guest. But first, we have to get to another great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Worldwide Technology. Now, WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center almost 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab around the world. Now, the lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs, and key partners ranging from high-tech heavyweights like VMware, Dell EMC, and Microsoft to emerging disruptors like Equinix. Now, for me, it's about trust. I want to be able to trust when I put an investment in something, right? That's the investment that continues to provide value. That's why WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their businesses run right. Now, their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation. It has a lot of things to offer. Listen to this. They have on-demand and schedulable labs like VMware Cloud on AWS, along with hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in networking virtualization, software-defined data centers, security, digital transformation, digital workspace, multi-cloud architecture and automation, and more. Now, learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which actually increases your speed to market. Now, they offer lab as a service. It's a dedicated lab with space within the ATC. Now, here customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has built. And in fact, it's virtual, so you can take advantage and its unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. Now, WWT's engineers work in these labs each and every day. They are beta testing new solutions, which are based on the latest and greatest VMware technologies. Plus, they're also building reference architectures and custom integrations to help customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. Now, WWT has launched their new digital platform, which includes the entire ATC ecosystem. Now, this ecosystem creates a multiplier effect that provides knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world with their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit to create an account and get access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on us. And today we have Sashi Kiran. He's the Chief Product Officer at Ariaka. Thanks so much for being here, Sashi.
Hey, Lou. I'm having fun listening to you guys and glad to be here.
So, yeah, we've touched on a lot of stuff today, and I think a lot of stuff actually relates to some of the stuff we're going to talk about with you. But before we get to that, I do know that my audience and our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through your journey through tech and what brought you to Ariaka?
Yeah, so my journey has been, that has taken me across continents. I'm originally from India, and I'm an engineer by education, but then, you know, got into different aspects of product entrepreneurship and marketing by profession. And once I decided to take, that career path, I originally, came to the United States back in the 90s to do a startup, which was a precursor to a lot of the infrastructure hosting that you see nowadays. And then, I charted out into bigger companies like Nortel, and I spent close to a decade at Cisco, where I was heading up, global portfolios for data center and cloud. And after I left Cisco, I wanted to go back to an early stage startup. And I went into something that was innovating on the cloud native application delivery space. It was an early stage Series A startup where you're kind of determining the product market fit. And it got acquired in about 7 months or so. And then I gravitated towards a mid-stage startup where you're building, routes to market. And this, incidentally, I was smiling when you were giving the promo for WWT, is this startup, it's called Qualy, builds that software that powers the ATC for WWT's environments. And it had a great clientele, and at the same time, I was instrumental in really rolling that out across different segments, introducing a SaaS version of it. And after having spent a couple of years there, I was looking to do something in the later stage where you are required to scale a company's, business trajectory, product velocity. And so that brought me to Ariaka. And Ariaka was kind of at the interesting nexus of having a technology that was primed for a greater degree of global penetration. And there was a requirement for us to maybe rejigger the product strategy a little bit, rejigger the go-to-market aspects a little bit, and fine-tune it to where it is aligning to a lot of the transformation efforts that is underway today. And that sort of combination of challenge as well as opportunity appealed to me. And so I took up this particular role in the January of 2019. So it's been a little over a year and a half. And I think it's been a really fun ride. So that's sort of been my career trajectory with a mixture of, you know, startups, bigger companies, product management, you know, business and marketing roles.
Fantastic. Now, obviously, this last year has been quite, not normal for organizations, and they are tend to be pivoting on being able to handle a little bit more remote connectivity and having remote businesses. What are you seeing here, and what are organizations doing to help expand their network, to make it more reliable, more consistent, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's cost a lot of organizations to have a rethink. You know, it's like you're going at 70 miles an hour on the freeway, and you're not expecting road bumps or potholes in the freeway, and you're cruising along, and suddenly you hit a series of speed bumps. And so there is this initial shock effect of really encountering that speed bump, and then you start to adapt to it, and then you start to expect it, and then you start to plan for it. And that's sort of the, you know, same analogy I draw with a lot of the enterprise architectures. I think, when we hit this particular situation starting in the March, April timeframe, nobody was in a position to predict how long it would last, whether it was temporary or permanent. And last quarter was a bit of everybody reacting and figuring out how to keep their businesses going. How do you mobilize your workforce so that they don't go dark and are still being able to be productive? And there were a lot of band-aid approaches, undertaken, I would say, last quarter. And now if I look at our own customers and some of the CIOs that I engage with, they are into looking forward in the last and really planning forward in a much more aggressive way for the next 2 to 3 years, both for hybrid work environments where they can look at, hey, do you want your network connectivity to be the same as you were having before with on-site office connectivity, or do you want to enable remote workers on a more permanent basis, or is it going to be something more hybrid? And so this rethink is accelerating a lot of initiatives that, you know, analysts like Gartner were forecasting over a 3 to 5 year horizon. And yesterday I was talking to some of my friends at Gartner, and they said that time frame has been compressed by more than 50%. And so that's really where, planning efforts are getting accelerated. And I think we will see a rethink of architectures and a major shift that's going to happen over the next 12 to 18 months.
Makes sense. And I think one thing that we're seeing, obviously, is a lot of organizations they're digitally transforming, they're moving to the cloud, but they're depending on a lot of different cloud services. They had to have this hybrid environment. And they're seeing, even with the initial and the additional traffic that is on their network and on their systems, that this can be difficult. What is something that an organization can do to help better that and better that experience when it comes to hybrid cloud?
Yeah, so I think hybrid cloud is really dependent on what is the degree of accountability a vendor or a provider can take, whether it's an on-premises situation or a public cloud situation or across the two. And eventually, the quality of the experience depends on the type of applications that you're trying to access. And we all, you know, saw this proliferation of Zoom take off so quickly. And in some ways, I think it was much more geared for this particular situation than many of the other web conferencing tools. And it was easier for enterprises to go adopt SaaS applications. I think that part of the shift started to thereby happen very quickly. Where things got, I guess, hung up a little bit was in their security posture. in terms of where they were in a position to guarantee, I would say, a better quality of experience for other applications. And you're starting to see the shift also happen from, you know, data center applications to more cloud hosted. And there are certain legacy applications that will not go away at all. And I think with some of the relationships that are being formed with public and private cloud vendors, and in a way that it really shouldn't matter where a workload is, and you're still able to guarantee the performance of that workload, that part of the equation I see being solved sooner. The place where I still think there are speed bumps are more in the wide area networking space, where to the conversation you guys were having before with the broadband connectivity, the last mile issues, the old copper. It is very hard to, guarantee that end-to-end SLA in many situations and provide a predictable experience. And that's really the problem, which is, top of mind for many CIOs today.
Right. Yeah, I think one thing that we see is a lot of organizations, they're moving to hybrid, but they're also using multiple different cloud providers. And these cloud providers might be global, but they don't always hit all of the different geolocations. And a lot of organizations are saying, okay, great, well then, maybe I'll use the one cloud provider that is in that area. Is there a way to simplify this? Because I know a lot of organizations are having this problem. They might be, in APAC or in Europe, and the like you said, connectivity and sometimes latency to these services are no good. And so they're trying to find alternate ways to fix this problem. And so rather than switching to ultimately being on one cloud service, they go to this more like multiple cloud service provider ways of doing things. But it creates a lot of complexity in their network. Is there ways to simplify this? Is there a way to make that better for organizations?
I think it is going to be a journey, Lou. And what we have seen over the last few years is an organization chooses a public cloud based on the type of application that they intend to run. So, for example, if they're predominantly a Windows or database firm, they're more likely to have gone with Azure. And most of the early adopters and the DevOps teams, they've all gone with AWS. And now I think we're seeing the shift happen where everybody realizes that, multi-cloud environments are going to be a reality. And at a minimum, it's going to be, one or two clouds. We had recently announced a relationship with Alibaba Cloud, which is sort of the number one public cloud provider in the Asia-Pacific region. But they have issues in really bringing their customers into a global environment, and for enterprise customers globally to get into Asia Pacific or China, where again they're number one. And so they are looking for companies that can help them normalize this multi-cloud connectivity. And so that is giving birth to a different set of use cases, if you will, where for an organization, how can you get away from the complexity that you mentioned? And regardless of the cloud provider you choose, can you normalize the experience, normalize the connectivity, bring about a degree of consistency? I think these are all the things that system integrators, providers are all looking at. And CSPs correspondingly are also recognizing that they're going to have a bigger, say in the whole equation, and they're building points of presence. They're getting closer to the edge. So whoever was just in the public cloud previously, they are looking to have that edge footprint and everything in between. So I think the next few years are going to be interesting in terms of who does the land grab, who does the WAN grab, and who can kind of dictate that end-to-end experience.
Right. Well, when we come back, we have a lot more to talk about here. And of course, I want to bring in the Curtis and Cheever because they have a bunch of questions here. But before we get to all that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ExpressVPN. Now, we all know how VPN protects your privacy and security online, but did you know that it can make it actually easier to watch TV and take it to the next level by unlocking movies and shows that actually aren't available in your country or even in your area. Now, you use ExpressVPN to binge on Doctor Who or Star Trek on the UK Netflix. It's simple. It's just fire up ExpressVPN app, change your location to the UK, and refresh Netflix, and that's it. There you go. You got the new content. Now, ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control what location you're at. Now, you can choose from almost 100 different countries, so just think about all the Netflix libraries you can get through. Love anime, use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it, it works. Now, there are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason I use ExpressVPN to watch shows is it's ridiculously fast, really low latency here. There's never any buffering or lag. You can stream at HD, no problem where you're at. Now, ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more, even routers. So you can watch what you want to watch and go on the big screen wherever you are. Now, if you travel a bunch, I travel globally here. I can tell you ExpressVPN adds peace of mind for me because it makes me feel comfortable about the traffic, making sure it's private to me no matter where I am. Plus, it gives me access to the content I want and provides my content fix for some of my favorite shows and all in HD. Now, I'm watching episodes of The Office from the UK, and you can't get that in the US. And all I have to do is enable ExpressVPN on my router, and I just leave it there, enabled. And I can watch the content on any one of my devices. I don't have to go and enable it on all the devices. It's automatically working for me. It's really nice, really easy to use. Now, if you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/enterprise, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/enterprise. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Sashik Haran. He's the Chief Product Officer at Ariaka. And I want to bring my co-host back in because there's lots going on in the environment and around the world with businesses. And there's lots of transitions, a lot of migrations from one technology to the next. Chibert, what are your thoughts here?
Well, one of my big questions is two parts. One is, I'm starting to see people using the pandemic as a driving force to move from traditional MPLS-based connections over to SD-WAN just so they can respond quicker to the changes. Because a lot of people are predicting that even once we start going away from working at home, we're going to start maybe having remote offices more. The other thing I'm starting to hear questions about is compatibility. There's a bunch of different people offering SD-WAN solutions, but is there any standards opening up? So I guess the question is, are you seeing the pandemic driving the migration from MPLS traditional connections over to SD-WAN? And have you heard of any kind of compatibility talks?
Yeah, so Brian, I think let me answer the first part of your question. And we've been actually surveying the market in terms of just MPLS adoption and the migration over the last few years. And I have, for example, here with me a global state of the WAN report, which we do a survey for. And in that, there is a section, you know, dedicated for MPLS migration. And we do this every year. And in fact, from the survey that we had from less than 12 months ago to now, post-COVID, we are seeing almost a doubling of people that are coming out to say that, hey, we want to move away from MPLS to more of cloud-first environments. And that's a big shift driven in part by need and in part by foresight, where they recognize, you know, the status quo will not remain. And so I do think you will see the need for networks, converged environments that are more agile, more adaptive, and I think more conducive for change management. And so MPLS has a lot of staying power in many places. And I would say some enterprises have inertia and they will keep it as long as, you know, providers continue to lower prices. And it is a proven environment with a lot of predictable application traffic engineering and things like that. But if they are looking at a shift in terms of their application posture and modernizing, it is going to be a a bit of a roadblock which causes friction. So I do think from almost 8 out of 10 conversations that I have, there is a definitive shift to accelerate away. And as long as, you know, contracts are done, they're starting the planning cycles sooner, right? And I think with regards to, you know, the broader theme, moving away from MPLS, we will see a bit of convergence of more agile networks, some moving towards SD-WAN, some moving towards target architectures, which also includes security. But eventually, it is about you know, either a complementary approach for certain parts of the network that you will go and roll up SD-WAN around and still preserve MPLS in a few other areas, or if you're in a position to do an overhaul and the cost aspects are compelling, then many organizations are willing to pull the trigger on that.
Now, you mentioned, you know, obviously being agile, and I think that's a tough challenge to have. Curtis, I want to throw this to you because you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I know that 2020 has changed the dynamic in a lot of ways for business. But one of the things that I was hearing companies say in 2019 and earlier, as they moved from MPLS to commodity internet, was just the time required to stand up a new installation of MPLS. If you wanted to provision a new office somewhere, pretty much anywhere around the world, commodity internet was very rapid, where MPLS could take weeks or months to have to get it provisioned. Is that something that you hear companies talk about when they're discussing this with you? And how do you compare your stand-up time for a new location versus that MPLS?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And a lot of this is relative. And so as far as, you know, our company is concerned, we're actually somebody that brings the benefits of predictability that MPLS had along with the agility that, you know, modern SD-WANs have. And so we're kind of a unique animal in that context. What we have seen, Curtis, is, you know, with traditional SD-WANs, which are really functioning as internet overlays, you're right, it is easy to get them stood up. And unlike MPLS, where it took several weeks to sometimes even months, depending on which part of the globe you were in, to stand up a circuit and to get things going. With SD-WAN, because of the internet overlay, it is relatively faster. But where, you know, traditional SD-WANs lose out is in bringing the same kind of predictability that MPLS offered. And when something goes wrong, it's harder to troubleshoot. And they're also not really geared for global traffic delivery. If an organization has distributed global offices, you know, most traditional SD-WAN are good as long as the quality of the underlying internet is good. And you know how that degrades as you go from one provider to another, one country or one continent to another. So there are, you know, pros and cons to both approaches. And just like, you know, one of your sponsors, Forward Networks, is trying to correlate the issues between overlay and underlay in the context of data center environments, a similar approach is required in wide area networks as well, where you have to make sure that the speed and the agility that, you know, SD-WANs promise is not coming at the cost of predictability and service experience. And so as long as you can bridge that gap with a solution that brings both to the equation, then you're in good hands. And just going back to, I guess, Brian's earlier question, part of it is hindered because there aren't any, you know, ubiquitous standards. And I don't anticipate there will be any in the near time future, just because a lot of it was driven by startups in a short period of time. And they were all coming with a time to market angle with their own proprietary innovation. And now you see some of the consolidation that's happening in the industry. So, you know, forums like the Metro Ethernet Forum, or to some extent our friends at Onuk, they're all trying to build something together, but maybe it's too little too late, and maybe it's never going to be, you know, the de facto standard.
Well, I want to press on that just a little bit, because you talk about the predictability of your connection, and I know that one area where that is huge is large-scale transactions. action processing. I mean, is SD-WAN to the point where it can be a viable large-scale OLTP network, or is this a case where in the overall evolution, companies still need to talk with their SD-WAN providers to get the right use case so that they're putting the right backbone network technology to use for the appropriate application?
I think that's a very important angle, Curtis. You know, most SD-WAN providers are really low-cost boxes suitable for do-it-yourself environments, and they're held hostage to the quality of the underlying backbone or network. And typically, the way they've gone to market is by partnering with a service provider that has a footprint in a certain geography or maybe a global provider. But even in that case, you see when there is a baton passing happening between a provider that's stronger in Europe with somebody who's in North America, it becomes hard to bring that kind of predictability and performance. And so consequently, we see a lot of cases where, particularly in this environment, where there was a sudden spike in video conferencing applications, for example, voice quality became pretty important. And as you can imagine, most networks were provisioned for a certain amount of traffic to go remote. But when you're essentially turning the dial on for 100% of your employees to go remote and for all of them to have performance and predictability and being productive, that was a hard problem to overcome. And it still is in many cases. Like I said, there has been a band-aid approach. So the more the underlying backbone is predictable, the more it is guaranteeing latency, the more it's guaranteeing aspects of jitter, then I think you will see this transition happen in a much more graceful way. And in the absence of that, I think it is going to be a stitched together set of entities that'll have a compromised view of how the performance is going to be.
Fantastic. So, Shi, thank you so much for being here. We're running just a bit low on time. I do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go and learn more about Arjaka and some of their offerings.
Yeah, so you can go check us up on arjaka.com. That's ARYAKA.com. And we call ourselves the Cloud First WAN Company. And we bring a global private backbone, which is with built-in WAN optimization, as well as our own SD-WAN technology at the edge. And we deliver it as a fully managed service for both network and security. So if you're looking for transforming your WAN, you know, be sure to check us out. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another Out of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
I am spackling. All kinds of fixing and repairs in the house and getting it ready to put on the market and move to the sunshine state of Florida. But you know what? I want to hear from you, our viewers. I am ADV, NETLAB, Advanced Net Lab on Twitter. Or feel free, I'm Chibert at twit.tv for drop me an email. And Chibert is spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. My students had a Dilbert naming theme, gee, I think. But you know what? Why don't you throw an email at twit.tv and that'll hit all the hosts. We want to hear from you. We want to, you know, I've got pretty thick skin. You know, if you have some complaints, let me have it. If you have ideas, let me have it. If you think you've got a problem, yeah, we'll take a stab at it. We want to hear from you. We want to hear you're good, you're bad, you're ugly. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you, Chibert. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin, the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
You know, I've got a bunch of great articles in the works, including an interview that I did with a researcher that I've known for a long time. But this is someone who has well over 300 CVEs published to his credit. And we talk about things like what life was like before the CVE process was in place, and how he had the experience of being the first individual researcher to be named his own CVE numbering authority. So got things like that coming up. Look for me at Dark Reading or on the edge of Dark Reading. Always happy to hear from members of the Twilight Riot. If you found something interesting or have something you particularly want to know, drop me a direct message at KG4GWA on Twitter or Kurt_Franklin over on Instagram.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show. We want to make it easier for you to watch and listen. Catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twilight. There you'll find all of the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, all the links we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and get it on any one of your podcast applications, your podcatchers. Check it out because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and get your Twilight fix. Now, it's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise news. So go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you might as well impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twilight, because we talk about a lot of fun tech subjects on this show. And I definitely think, and I guarantee they will find it interesting as well. After you subscribe, of course, remember, we should do this show live each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time over here at twit.tv. That's live.twit.tv. That's right. That's the website you go to. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see the show behind the scenes, all the fun stuff we do here at Twit. Watch the show live. And of course, if you can watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a lot of great characters, a lot of great people bringing some good questions and some good content to the show. So check that out at irc.twit.tv. And of course, if you can't watch the show live and you can't be in the chat room, but you still want to be part of the discussion and the conversations, check out our great website out there, twit.community, 24/7 discussion. All of our hosts are out there. We talk about each and every show. We talk about a lot of tech subjects. So go out there and check it out. Twit.community is a great way to stay on top of everything. We want to hear from you, our audience. We've had some amazing moments on our programs this year. So go out right now, submit your favorite moments at twit.tv/bestof, and we'll play them the week of Christmas. Looking forward to it. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There you can find all my enterprise tidbits. I have great conversations with people like you. And of course, I also post a little bit about my daily work job at Microsoft. There I talk about how you can customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. And of course, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. We couldn't do this show. We want to thank Leo and Lisa without them, because they continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we wouldn't want to do it without them. So thank you for all the support. Of course, thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. And of course, thank you one more time. I thank him one more time because Mr. Brian Chiebert, he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer for the show. He does all the bookings and plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Chiebert, for all your support. And before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, of course, Mr. Victor, but of course, we also have to thank our TD for today, Ant Pruitt. Ant, how are you doing, my friend? How's it going over there at the Twit Studios?
Unbelievable as always, sir. Just doing what we do.
Indeed, indeed. Definitely check out all of Ant's great content he puts out. Hands on Wellness, Hands on Photography. He's also on This Week in Google. Lots of great stuff. So definitely check that out at the twit.tv website. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twit.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, host at Twit TV. Got a question for you. Have you gotten tired of how bad your photos are looking every time you post them to Instagram? Better yet, have you gotten yourself a new camera and you can't quite figure out why the images just don't look that good? Well, I have a solution for you. It's my show, Hands On Photography. Each and every Thursday, I sit down and share different tips and tricks that are going to help make you a better photographer and a better post processor. So subscribe today at twit.tv/hop to learn more.